You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new poll looks at Americans' feelings about the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll check out the results, and you can weigh in, too. Now, Republicans in the state legislature say the University of Wisconsin system can't put COVID-19 restrictions in place without their approval. On Tuesday, Republicans on a state legislative committee voted to require UW to submit coronavirus safety measures within 30 days. That includes policies like mask mandates, vaccine requirements, and mandatory COVID-19 testing. The move means lawmakers could strike down those COVID protocols the same day fall classes start for a lot of students. A note for listeners, Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of UW-Madison. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should the state legislature have a say in COVID-19 measures UW system puts in place? What do you think the fall semester will look like without public health measures to prevent the spread of the virus? If you are a UW student or teacher or staff member or parent of a student anywhere in the state, call in and share your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter who covers higher education. He's based in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Good to be back.
Well, this committee is the Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules. Tell us a little more about what they did on Tuesday and what it means for UW.
On Tuesday, there was basically a party line split. The Republicans on the committee voted 6-4, with all Democrats opposing, to basically direct the University of Wisconsin system to submit any sort of COVID-19 safety measures that relate to physical access to buildings or you know, COVID-19 policies that might carry disciplinary action with them. They want them all submitted as an emergency rule to this committee, and the committee then would vote on that. So the university system has 30 days to get this information in an emergency rule format to the committee. And there's an expectation from a lot of people that the rules will then just be rejected by the committee.
Right. This could, with that timing you just mentioned, if they submit now, then they could be rejected right around the day students are starting to show up in class. Is that about right?
Yeah, essentially the day that the committee made the vote, 30 days after that would be September 2nd. And that's when most campuses, 8 out of the 13 UW universities, will start their classes. So the timing, it seems, you know, pretty specific that they're doing this now. But other campuses start the next week, basically. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
What have we heard from Republicans on this committee about why they wanted to have this rule?
Well, Senator Steve Noss of Whitewater, State Senator Steve Noss, mentioned that prior to taking this vote, he put out a press release saying that he was going to do this. And he said that some chancellors in the UW system have used used the Delta variant of the coronavirus to kind of whip up hysteria and go beyond where they should with regards to restrictions like face masks and things like that. They also mentioned that the UW system has to do this anyway under the law, which is interesting because, you know, the University of Wisconsin system, their rules are made via the UW Board of Regents. And I don't remember maybe one other example where the UW system actually put rules forward to this committee for approval. And that other example that I bring up is when about 3 years ago, the UW system was coming up with rules on campus free speech and punishments for students that disrupt speakers repetitively. So it's kind of a novel approach from where I'm sitting.
What have we heard from UW system leadership, including interim president, former governor, Tommy Thompson?
Yeah. So when Senator Noss first mentioned that he was going to go this route, Tommy Thompson, interim president of the UW system, put out a statement saying that basically, you know, it's going to make it harder for UW campuses to stay open. And by that, he means, you know, have in-person classes and do the things that they say students want to do, you know, have be able to meet on campus, go to classes, and hold extracurricular activities. This, you know, obviously comes a year after everything was essentially put online, and a lot of students didn't like that. So Thompson says that without being able to do anything really to try to mitigate the virus on campus or encourage vaccinations, it's just going to make it harder, or could make it harder for them to try to stay the course and bring things kind of back to normal.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter who covers higher education, looking at a Republican-led committee in the state legislature saying that the UW system will have to submit COVID safety measures for approval. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just wondering if COVID has an incredible ally in the Republican Party in Wisconsin. They walked out of COVID emergency meetings a year ago. They never showed up at the Capitol for over 270 days. And they fought mask mandates, gathering limitations, and social distancing during this entire thing. I don't understand the motivation. And this is purely political. It has nothing to do with medical. Steve Nass has no medical background. No one on this committee has medical background. They're just doing it to fire up an unfortunately ignorant base. And I want to know, what is the legal standing that they have to even say they can do this with UW?
Tom, thanks for that call. Let's jump on that last point. Rich, is there an expectation that one way or another this may end up in courts?
Yes. The short answer is yes. The legal standing, I reached out to what's known as legislative counsel. They are essentially lawyers that work for state lawmakers. And the answer that I got was pretty basic, is that UW system is a state agency like others. And therefore, they're required to, you know, follow these laws and submit things to this committee. Again, what's interesting is that that just hasn't been the process in the past, that UW has been able to do its rules through the Board of Regents. But there is an expectation that this will wind up in court one way or another. You know, one person that mentioned that outright was State Representative Lisa Subek, a Democrat on the committee, who was very angry. She says, she told me that I have no idea what statutory authority Senator Nass thinks that he has. And it's just going to go to court. She believes that the courts would rule in the UW system's favor. So I'm not sure what'll happen, but it seems like it's very possible that this could make it through the courts.
Thanks a lot for that call. Rich, as I understand it, UW campuses have not had vaccine requirements, but dominoes are falling when it comes to mask requirements. What's going on?
That's right. Just minutes before joining the program, University of Wisconsin Eau Claire and University of Wisconsin Stout, two of the campuses in my neck of the woods, I'm up in Eau Claire, they issued a joint statement saying that they're going to bring back face masks for everybody, regardless of your vaccination status. And that follows three campuses that did it already. I think UW-Milwaukee was the first, maybe a week or two ago, that they instituted a mask mandate. UW-Madison and UW-La Crosse have as well. And I've already been asked, you know, can they do that, you know, without, you know, because of what's going on with this committee? And it sure seems that they believe they can. And the way I understand it is that whatever they're doing just has to make it through the emergency rule process, you know, and be submitted within those 30 days, which would be August 2nd. So, yes, that I have a hunch that we're going to see more and more UW campuses, some technical colleges, and some private schools have also brought back masks with regards to the rise in daily COVID cases and the Delta variant.
Rich, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next when it comes to COVID guidelines on campuses versus what's going on in the legislature?
Well, it's kind of like deja vu. I mean, a year ago, we're just about to the point where students start to move back into the dorms. And I remember a lot of students were concerned about their safety on campus. I'm going to have to start looking at that again. Like you mentioned, it doesn't look like there's going to be any vaccine mandates for UW campuses, but they're certainly doing a lot of things to try to incentivize students. I mean, Thompson has offered 70 different or $500,000 worth of scholarships through a lottery system for students that prove that they've been vaccinated. His goal is to get them, get campuses above 70% across the state. So really what I'm watching is what happens with this committee and that, you know, maybe the court action after that, if it goes to the courts, but also just going to try to talk to some students before they start moving into the dorms.
Before I let you go, Rich, let's hear from Paul in Richland Center. Paul, hi.
Hey, thank you very much. I am so angry at Steve Nass and his committee that I will clean up my language. I'm calling in defense of Tommy Thompson. I've never been a fan of Tommy Thompson as his many years of governor of this state, but he's trying to do the right thing for the university system, to keep these students in face-to-face classes and keep the economies going of the cities in which these universities are placed. The two cities that I am most familiar with are, I'm a graduate of UW-Whitewater. Whitewater wouldn't exist.
But Paul, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a lot of time left with Rich, but that role of Tommy Thompson, now Republican leader of the state for a long time, HHS secretary under the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, now finds himself at odds with his former Republican colleagues.
Yeah, this certainly isn't the first time. I mean, there during the budget negotiations, there was some tension between Tommy, or at least with the UW system and lawmakers. A lot of people thought that Tommy would be able to swoop in and kind of get whatever he wanted. Didn't work that way. But yes, it's going to be really interesting to see how he's got the experience as HHS secretary, as you mentioned. And he also said with regards to vaccinations that he doesn't believe that UW could require them because it's under an emergency use authorization. Other universities around the country have, but so yeah, it there's some tension.
Rich, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Reb.
That's Rich Kramer. He covers higher education for WPR. He's based in Eau Claire. Up next, we'll talk to a national higher education reporter about how this is working out at colleges and universities and states around the country when it comes to COVID-19 safety measures. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should colleges require mask wearing or vaccinations? Are you involved with a campus as a student, faculty, staff member, parent of student? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about universities and colleges and how they're handling COVID-19 safety measures ahead of the fall semester. We just heard what's going on in Wisconsin and the state legislature. Let's look elsewhere now. Elizabeth Redden is with us, reporter for Inside Higher Ed, who's been covering mask and vaccine mandates in higher education. You can join in with your thoughts on the topic at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You have been following this issue. We're not alone in Wisconsin, right? This is a hot topic on campuses around the country.
Oh, absolutely. I think every campus in the country obviously is grappling with the changing circumstances brought about by the Delta variant and trying to figure out what to do this fall. Wisconsin's not alone there. It's not alone in terms of reimposing mask mandates. And it's also not alone in facing state-level restrictions on that seek to limit in some way some of the responses they might be able to universities might be able to put forward.
Before we dig into specific cases, Elizabeth, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like everybody is intending and hoping to do in-person college, right? Nobody is aiming to go virtual this fall if they can at all help it. Do I have that right?
By and large, yes. I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. I always hesitate to say absolutely no one's going to be virtual, but by and large, people are planning for an in-person semester. We're really, most of the conversations are centering around things like vaccine mandates versus vaccine incentivizing vaccines, mask mandates, et cetera. But most are wanting an in-person semester as close to normal as possible.
Let's look at vaccine mandates. Here in Wisconsin, we've got some of our biggest private colleges and universities, including Marquette, saying, yeah, vaccinations, public, UW system, nope. The legislature probably wouldn't let them do that. Are you seeing a lot of mandated vaccines in higher education around the country?
Yeah, so we're seeing right now there's more than 600 colleges nationally that have mandated vaccines for either faculty or for either employees or students or both. So we are seeing a good number that are going that direction. We've also seen some movement toward I think accelerated movement toward embracing vaccine mandates over the past 2 weeks or so with the rise of the Delta variant. For example, in Michigan, University of Michigan and Michigan State just announced a vaccine mandate for all faculty, students, and staff last week. I think it was last Friday. The University of California and California State University both moved up the timeline for their vaccine requirements. They were originally going to wait until the FDA gave one of the three vaccines full approval. Currently, they're authorized for emergency use, but they decided to go ahead and move up the timeline and require the vaccines for this fall for everyone. So we are certainly seeing, I think, an acceleration in uptick of the vaccine mandate approach, but there are a lot of places that are not requiring vaccines, and in many places where there are political considerations that limit their ability to do so.
We just talked about a handful of UW campuses having now mask mandates in place as of today or kicking in soon. How common are mask mandates around the country?
Yeah, I think that's another area where we're seeing a lot of change over the past week or so. So last week, the CDC revised its guidance to recommend that people should wear masks indoors while in public, regardless of their vaccination status. That represented a change from the previous guidance. So in the wake of that, we are seeing more colleges reimpose mask mandates for indoor spaces.
Now, to compare and contrast, we just talked about a conflict between the university and a part of the state government in Wisconsin. You covered South Carolina. What's going on there?
Yeah, so University of South Carolina is one example of a state that did just what I mentioned after the CDC, I believe it was after the CDC revised their guidance last week. They came out and said that they were going to require masks on campus. I'm sorry, masks while indoors on campus. So they reimposed a mask mandate, but they had to back away from that yesterday, and they said they would no longer require masks while indoors on campus after the state attorney general issued an advisory opinion essentially saying that a law that was passed by the legislature this year was intended to bar mandatory mask wearing on campuses as well as mandatory vaccination.
Talking to Elizabeth Redden, reporter for Inside Higher Ed, about how colleges and universities are handling things like a mask mandates, vaccination requirements for the fall semester, and conflicts in some cases, as in Wisconsin, between public universities and their state governments. Elizabeth, are we seeing a difference depending on who controls the state government in how this is being treated?
We are. I mean, the restrictions are largely, if not entirely, in states that have we're seeing coming from Republican governors or Republican-controlled legislatures.
What are some of the things you're watching for right now as, you know, there's just a few weeks left and places are scrambling with these new guidelines. What is still up in the air at a lot of campuses right now?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I think one thing I've been thinking about a lot is, probably the biggest thing is what the vaccination numbers end up shaking out as being at a lot of campuses. So even whether universities are requiring vaccines or not, a lot are keeping close tabs, have asked students to report whether they're vaccinated or to provide documentation of whether they're vaccinated by a certain date. Many of those dates are just around now. Some of them were August 1st. Some are doing August 15th. You know, so really we're in that window of period where students are reporting their vaccination status. So I think a lot of universities are holding their breath to see what percentage of students report vaccination. So I think that's one variable. I think another variable is, frankly, you know, I think prior to a lot of the fall plans were put in place, you know, toward the end of the spring. That was when planning was really, a lot of this planning was happening. And at that point, you know, cases were dropping nationally. Vaccinations were, you know, continuing apace. And there was, I think, a lot of optimism about the fall. And, you know, with what we're learning about the Delta variant in terms of its increased transmissibility, what we're seeing, concerns we've been hearing about that, you know, have, I think, just thrown a wrench in a lot of colleges' plans and forced them to really rethink all sorts of policies. So I will be interested to see if we see changes to other policies in the coming weeks. I mean, I think the mask mandates and the vaccine mandates are the two areas where we've seen the most movement, but I'm certainly curious to see what we see in terms of some of the other restrictions that were in place last fall. Do we see places restricting group sizes? Do we see places, enforcing social distancing or physical distancing in the classrooms? I mean, I think there's still a lot of variables that colleges are thinking about because the underlying circumstances have changed with the Delta variant.
And earlier this week, you covered a statement from the American College Health Association and a bunch of other higher education groups critical of states that limit their university's ability to do things like require masks. In our last few moments, what case did they make?
Yeah, so essentially these groups, so the American College Health Association joined with about two dozen other higher education groups, including, you know, some of the major higher education associations like American Council on Education. They were pretty strong in their wording. They said that states that are restricting the ability of colleges to do things like, there are some states that are restricting the ability of colleges to require vaccines, public colleges in particular, some that are restricting the ability to require masks. There are some that are even restricting the ability to do things to require testing in certain circumstances, COVID testing. So the statement was quite strong. It described these sorts of restrictions as dangerous. It said that some of these restrictions directly contradict guidance from the CDC, that they undermine, I'm quoting, they undermine the ability of all organizations, including colleges and universities, to operate safely and fully at a time of tremendous unpredictability. So they were quite strong in saying that you guys are don't handcuff universities. They need to have as much flexibility as possible.
And Elizabeth, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Elizabeth Redden, reporter at Inside Higher Ed, with us today to talk about the ways that colleges and universities around the country are approaching COVID-19 safety measures ahead of the fall semester. A new poll asked Americans how they feel about the U.S. Supreme Court. Perhaps the most surprising find, even though the court has gotten more conservative with Donald Trump's appointments, conservatives not happy with it. We're talking about new poll results about the U.S. Supreme Court, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have your feelings about the U.S. Supreme Court changed since Ruth Bader Ginsburg died and Amy Coney Barrett was appointed? Do you pay close attention to the Supreme Court or just the major cases? How did you feel about the court's decision to keep the Affordable Care Act in place? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School poll and developer of pollsandvotes.com. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back with you, Rob.
Well, let's start off. This is a national poll. A lot of times we talk to you about your Wisconsin polls. You're going nationwide on this Supreme Court survey.
That's right. For the last 2 years, in 2019 and 2020, we did one national poll on the Supreme Court in September of both of those years. This year, we're expanding that to six polls a year, polling every other month, because we want to follow the thinking about the court throughout the year, not just once after the term is over and all the decisions are done. We want to see how that develops and how people are thinking about it throughout the year.
Before we get to what people think about the court, do people think about the court? At least some of the questions you have about rating individual justices, there was a majority of people said, I don't know enough about that justice to even have an opinion. How close are we Americans watching our Supreme Court?
I think it's a very split decision in the sense that virtually everybody is willing to tell us whether they approve or disapprove of the job the court's doing. Virtually everybody is willing to tell us whether they trust the court or the presidency or the Congress most. So in those broad ways, people have opinions about the court and they're perfectly willing to express them. But when you ask them specific names of justices and whether they've heard enough to have an opinion about that justice, there we see awareness go way down to a low. The least well-known member, Justice Breyer, only 24% knew enough to give an opinion of him. And the best known justice only was at 58% with an opinion of him. So there in those specific details, you see a lot less awareness. And as I'm sure we'll talk about, there's some variation in what people know and what they know that isn't true. And so misperception becomes part of this as well.
Well, I teased one of the interesting findings from this latest poll. The court got three Republican appointees under the Trump administration generally perceived as moving the court in a conservative direction. But Republican people polled, Republicans polled, not necessarily happy with the court. What did you see when the when you looked at those trends?
Yeah, I think this is the most intriguing question about how people perceive the court and responded to it over the last year. Our September 2020 poll finished interviewing the day before Justice Ginsburg died. And so all of the responses from a year ago were with her still on the court, a 5-4 conservative majority on the court. And with the addition of Justice Barrett, appointed by President Trump, confirmed by a Republican Senate, you might have expected that that new 6-3 conservative majority would be something that Republicans would become more happy about. But what we actually found was the opposite. In 2020, 80% of Republicans said they approved of the job the court was doing, and that fell to 57% this year. Independents are at 61, Democrats at 50 this year, so not a whole lot of change for independents or Democrats. Those were pretty close to where they were a year ago. But this dramatic change with Republicans, despite the fact that they went to a bigger conservative majority, six justices appointed by Republican presidents, only three appointed by Democratic presidents. And so that leaves an interesting question of why that is. I've seen people suggest that maybe it's because the court this year didn't move as far as conservatives might have hoped for it to move with such a large majority. But we don't see any evidence for that. In our data, Republicans see the court in ideological terms just a little bit more conservative than they saw it last year. Democrats a little more conservative, but still not a huge shift among Democrats either. If you thought Republicans were really disappointed with the court, they might have moved it further to the middle of the ideological scale, and that didn't happen. But what we do see is a pretty sharp misperception of the composition of the court. In the whole sample, 30% say the court definitely has a majority appointed by Democrats. Appointed by Republicans. And 45% say it probably does. 24% believe it's still a Democratic majority, which it hasn't been for years. But among Republicans, only 16% say it's definitely a Republican majority. In contrast, 44% of Democrats say it's definitely a Republican majority. And 30% of Republicans believe it's definitely or probably a Democratic majority. So this misperception matters. For those Republicans that think it's a Democratic majority, approval's at only 43%, whereas those who know correctly that it's a Republican majority, it's 64% approval.
Talking to Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, about a new survey, part of an ongoing series on what Americans think of the Supreme Court. What do you think of the Supreme Court? What do you think of the composition of it right now? Do you worry about its rulings on contentious political issues? Is there a ruling that you liked or disliked over the last, say, year or so? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Charles, you compare and contrast what Americans think about their attitude toward the Supreme Court versus the other peaks of our three-branch system. How does the court stack up against the White House and against Congress?
Yeah, the court, in our data as well as in most other data, looks fairly good. It on trust, which institution do you trust the most? The court gets 58% picking them, 28% pick the presidency, 13% pick Congress. That's hardly changed from last year when it was 59 for the court, 24 for the president, 16 for Congress. Within that, there have been some changes. Lots of Republicans trusted the presidency last time, and they don't this time. And conversely, lots of Democrats didn't trust the presidency and now do. So that shift in Democrats and Republicans is large about the presidency, but it nets out to very little change. Well, the court stands out there with this pretty substantial 58% choosing them as the most trusted.
You asked some questions that seem to try to get at the issue of politicization of the court and whether the court is a political institution versus some sort of abstract legal institution. Some questions kind of nibble at least around the edges of that. What kind of things were you looking for? What kind of things do you see?
Sure. We ask a question that others have asked and we've asked for the last few years. Do you think when the justices make their decisions, do they base them primarily on the law or primarily on politics? And this year, we got 71% who said primarily the law and 29% said primarily politics. Last year, it was 62 primarily law, 37 politics. So primarily law has actually gone up by about 9 points over that time. And interestingly, here there are majorities of every party that say primarily the law. It's a little bigger for Republicans than it is for Democrats, but it's still a healthy majority of Democrats that say the court's rulings are primarily based on the law.
You also looked at some particular rulings, including a ruling on the latest challenge to the Affordable Care Act that ultimately kept it in place. What reactions did you hear from people?
Well, there are two things. One is how familiar people are with each of the six rulings we asked about. And their familiarity varies a lot. The Affordable Care Act was the most visible decision, with 60% having an opinion about that. And a substantial majority favored the decision that was reached in that case, preventing an effort to overturn the Affordable Care Act. And a minority said that they opposed that decision. That's in line with the question we asked last year, looking ahead to the case before it was decided, with a substantial majority favoring upholding the Affordable Care Act.
We're talking to Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, developer of pollsandvotes.com. He's talking to us about the latest survey on how Americans feel about the U.S. Supreme Court. And you could join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you trust the U.S. Supreme Court as an institution? Do you think they make decisions based on politics or based on the law and legal precedent? Do you think there should be more justices on the court or not? That's another question asked on the survey that we can get into. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Marquette Law School poll director Charles Franklin about how Americans are feeling about the U.S. Supreme Court and how that's changed over time. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 on the current makeup of the court, rulings you've seen from them, worries you hope or fear to see from them down the road. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Terry is with us in Superior. Terry, hello.
Hello, how's your day going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Terry?
Well, there was a ruling, because I read them every once in a while, and there was the ruling about the police officer who was selling the data out of the federal database for criminals and the state database for criminals, and they had ruled just a very strange thing, saying that you can't remove his ability to still access the data. You couldn't punish him. You couldn't go after him. And he was selling it for profit outside of his duty as a police officer, and I still didn't understand the ruling. I just thought it was strange.
Terry, thanks a lot for that call. I'm looking at an article about that. It is kind of a puzzling story, but Charles, I don't, do we see people bewildered sometimes by U.S. Supreme Court rulings? Can that shape the way we think about the court?
Yes, I agree. And I think that this is a good example of a ruling that you know, seldom becomes prominent in public discussion. And the details of the case are complicated and sort of what was the basis of that ruling. So I think this is a good example of one that, as I understand it, and let me disclaim here, I'm not super familiar with that case either, but I believe that it had to do with the unauthorized use of a database and under what statutes could that be prosecuted. And so it was a fairly technical ruling about whether that statute covers the kinds of things he was doing, rather than whether it was a good or a bad thing that he was accessing it and selling the data.
Thanks a lot for the call, Terry, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Beth on the line in Eau Claire. Beth, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, what do you want to bring up, Beth?
Well, my comment and question is, you mentioned the number of justices on the Supreme Court, but I think a more intriguing and practical issue might be term limits, and arbitrarily 20 years or so.
Beth, thanks a lot for the call. A contentious issue, the idea of adding more justices or having term limits. I know you polled people, Charles, about the idea of adding justices. I can't remember if there was a question about term limits.
Well, we did ask about expansion this time, but we asked about term limits last time, so I can speak to both. A year ago, a pretty substantial majority favored term limits, though we didn't specify how long those limits should be. But that has turned out to be a relatively popular proposal to change the court. The problem practically is that it almost surely requires a constitutional amendment, because the Constitution says they should serve for a term of good behavior. As for expanding the court, we found a pretty even split, 48% favoring an expansion of the court, 51% opposed, and a big party split on this, 3/4 of Republicans opposed to expanding the court, 3/4 of Democrats in favor.
Thanks a lot for that call. Had you asked about the court expansion idea previously in these surveys? Because I know it became a more hot topic just this year.
That's right. We have asked about it. Last year, the split was a little more opposed to expanding. So it's moved from a small majority that were opposed to expansion a year ago to, as I say, a 48-51, essentially a dead even split now.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talk about American attitudes and thoughts about the U.S. Supreme Court. Charles Franklin is with us, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, where they've been doing ongoing nationwide surveys to see what we think. We're looking at the newest edition of that survey. Still time for your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Charles, you survey people about individual justices, and you mentioned earlier, in many cases, the not sure what to think about them or don't know about them is the majority. Were there justices, though, that stood out to you as particularly well-liked or particularly divisive among the people you surveyed?
Yeah. So to begin, there is this big variation from the least well-known justice that only 24% say they know enough to give a rating to 58% for the best known. Interestingly, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, is in the middle of the nine justices, with just 43% able to give an opinion about him. Most of the justices have more a favorable view than unfavorable. The two most recent appointees, Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh, are the two that are more evenly split, with Coney Barrett having a 27-26 favorable unfavorable, and Justice Kavanaugh 26 favorable, 32 unfavorable, the one justice with a net negative. Surely that is partly due to the controversies surrounding both of their appointments. In the case of Coney Barrett, in the closing days of the Trump administration, and in Kavanaugh's contentious hearings over his initial appointment a few years ago. Everyone else, though, ends up with a net positive of the people that have an opinion of them.
I'm going to guess, though, that polarization is going to be pretty strongly on partisan lines when it comes to Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett.
Yes, though it's also true of the other justices. You know, we've been talking about how limited the knowledge of the court is, and that's absolutely right. But people do manage in a rough and ready way to connect their partisan views to the justices, and interestingly, also to the cases, so that whether it's a justice appointed by a Republican president or seen as a conservative, or decisions that lean in a conservative or a liberal way, Democrats and Republicans line up behind their side, whether that's the justice or the case, and they do that in a pretty regular way across less-known cases, better-known cases, less-known judges, and better-known justices. The one interesting exception, again, is John Roberts, where Democrats have a more favorable view of him, whereas Republicans are about evenly split on Roberts, who was appointed by George W. Bush, a Republican president.
How important is a Supreme Court justice appointment toward people come Election Day? What kind of things do we see when we ask people about that?
Well, we see 51% who say the Supreme Court appointments are very important to them, so about half. On the other hand, when we push a little harder, it's maybe as few as 25% or so that know most of the justices or know most of the cases, so that familiarity matters. When we looked at it a year ago in the midst of the 2020 election, there was a clear relationship between how people said the court was very important to them and their choice of presidential candidate. So again, they lined up their politics about the court with their politics about who they were supporting for president.
Time for one more caller. Pat is with us in Kenosha. Pat, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I'm really against term limits because I think once justices get on the court, they tend to go by their own conscience if there's no populism involved. They can immerse themselves in what's right and wrong in the law, and they can be above that. And I think that's a system that works. If you put term limits on it, it's political.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. That's the intention, I think, behind lifetime appointments for the justices, though others make the case that the appointments end up being political anyway. Charles, your thoughts on that in our last minute?
Yeah, I think there's good evidence, of course, that appointments are political, whether we want them to be or not. The president and the senators certainly make them more political, regardless of what the justices say or do. I do think there's also empirical evidence that a few justices have shifted their voting behavior on the court over time. People like Sandra Day O'Connor, who moved to be a more moderate justice, and a couple of others in recent years who've done that, while others have maintained their liberal or conservative credentials throughout their time on the court. There is a presidential commission considering these issues and taking a lot of testimony about it. And to no one's surprise, whether term limits are a good or bad idea is highly contested. But it's interesting to see that debate and to see the public, as with this caller, joining in that debate and considering the pluses and the minuses of term limits.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette University Law School Poll and the developer of pollsandvotes.com. He talked to us today about the latest survey from the Center, a national view of how Americans feel about the U.S. Supreme Court.